Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
One of my favorite subjects is unsolved mysteries and lost technology of ancient civilizations. Today we have back with us the world traveler himself, Brad Olson, going to talk about his appearance coming up at the Contact in the Desert, June 25th through the 28th. We're going to talk about some of his lectures and workshops, unsolved mysteries of South America, lost technologies, megaliths of Peru and Bolivia, and hidden anomalies of the Antarctica. He took a trip down there, and we're going to find out if there's anything new to share with us right here on Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome back to the Truth Be Told studios the one and only Brad Olson.
Hey, Tony. Wow, what a great audience cheers you have there in the background.
Normally people don't show up, but as soon as I said Brad Olson, they just flock to the studio. So I thought, sure, why not? Let them in. They all have masks on, though. Just kidding. Well, I'm excited. You and I both, you're going to be speaking at Contact in the Desert this year. You have some great subjects that you're going to be speaking about. I'm going to be interviewing and maybe doing some introduction for some of the speakers, so I'm excited to be a part of it. And unfortunately this year it's all virtual, so this is kind of what you're going to see. And I hope your hand doesn't cramp holding up your phone for the next 4 or 5 hours.
No, I'll make it work one way or another.
Well, let's just start off explain to some of these people that maybe not know some of your work and some of the past expeditions and your world traveling. You went to the Antarctica, which not very many people get the opportunity to do that. What was your goal when you went down, and did you get to get any explanation for some of the myths and some of the mysteries of the Antarctica?
Yeah, Tony, I think I'm one of the only researchers in this field who has gone down there with the express purpose of looking into many of these strange anomalies that we've heard related to Antarctica, such as massive 3-mile wide crafts under the ice. Mm-hmm. And they even have a nickname, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria from the alphabet agencies from Columbus's ship.
That's funny.
Also, I was looking into antediluvian civilizations, such as the pyramids poking through the ice, or any kind of word on archaeological digs going on there. And of course, any under ice, underground bases that may be there now. It's a long shot to try to find this kind of thing just by asking sea captains in Ushuaia or going to the research stations to determine whether or not they knew anything about this stuff. Right. Try as I might, I didn't come up with any affirmations of anyone knowing this stuff. Not to say that they were trying to hide something. I just don't think people knew it. A lot of people that go down there and work in the research bases, well, they're there as interns, or they're young, right, or they're just involved with what they're down there assigned to do. They were interested. They were kind of more curious as to why I was even asking these questions and wanted to know more from me. But we did find a few things, and that is, there was one guy who was studying the ice fish at an Argentinian base. And he said, quite reluctantly, at first he didn't want to tell, that there was a UFO sighting at another one of their sister bases called the Belgrano 2, which happens to be in eastern Antarctica, not too far away from the New Schwabenland claim of Nazi Germany in the late 1930s. And they had seen some crafts and orbs flying over the base a month before I was there, and word got back to their other sister bases that there was some UFO activity. The other thing we found out was there's definitely a big no-fly zone near the South Pole. And that's really interesting because that is the reported giant hole in the ice reported by Admiral Byrd himself doing his flyovers of Antarctica and seeing it about 40 miles across, big enough that he felt that he could drop his plane in, turn around, and fly back out, according to his diaries. Yeah, there it is. And also some of Linda Moulton Howe's whistleblowers, one in particular named Brian S., who said he flew over it and saw it, and it's quite amazing. So there are little tidbits there, as well as Antarctica being the most volcanically active continent in the world, with the propensity of these giant holes or other domes under the ice to appear. It's just the nature of a giant polar plateau, which is 2 miles deep,
right,
in most places.
Well, let me ask you this. So we know that the military is down there. So what military is down there besides the United States? Is there multiple different countries down in Antarctica, or is it mostly the U.S.?
Well, the military can come down and deliver supplies. They can assist in a rescue.
Right.
But per the Antarctica Treaty, which was fully ratified in 1961, it is one of the best world treaties that still remains to this day, which creates a giant biosphere for the entire continent. Everything right below the 60 degree south parallel is protected. It's like not a national park, but a world biopreserve. And one of the stipulations is there is not to be any military activity. It's a nuclear free zone, so there's right no testing or doing any kind of nuclear activity. And that's kind of interesting because the U.S. was doing military operations there in the late 1950s, including Operation Argus, which is still to this day a top secret nuclear test done in the Southern Oceans, not too far away from that infamous New Schwabenland claim. Right. And so the alternative narrative about what they were doing and why it's still top secret is they were lobbing a couple nukes over onto New Schwabenland to put an end to that Fourth Reich New Berlin base once and for all. So, Tony, if I were ever able to go back there, say, with a film crew and some equipment, I'd love to go to this area with some Geiger counters.
Wouldn't that be great?
And see if we could pick up radiation. And that might actually prove if that's what Argus was all about.
So tell me, if since there's these treaties, then who implemented the no-fly zone?
Well, that is part of
the treaty?
The treaty is that other countries are allowed to... the cover story is that they are doing quite a few very sensitive scientific experiments at South Pole, and therefore a plane coming over would pollute or create sounds or vibration that would throw off their instruments. And so if that is what they're saying to the international community, then the international community goes along with it. And there are other, I do know of some other areas of Antarctica that are considered off limits. But for the most part, you can pretty much go wherever you want. And I know this because I've talked to some adventure travel companies and I said, well, look, what if we wanted to mount an expedition to check out one of these pyramids poking out under the ice? And they said, well, they're what we call nunataks, just attractive mountains poking through. But if you wanted to, we could do it. It's just always a matter of money because it's very expensive to travel down there. And you have to pack everything in. You have to wait for the weather conditions before you can do certain expeditions. So there's a lot of variables, and everybody that comes along has to be trained professionals, and they don't come cheap either. So just a very minimalistic expedition, starting price $250,000. It's probably gone up from there.
Wow. I'm sure you could write that check, I'm sure, Brad.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to go through, but I can write
it. Right. I can write it. Yeah. So what are some of the whistleblowers saying and that are credible, that we know that definitely there might be something down there that's worth knowing about?
Sure. Well, there are not a whole lot of really credible whistleblowers. Some that we know by name have spoken at Contact in the Desert. Corey Good, he says he's been to some of these under ice bases, as well as Emery Smith. You also have the whistleblowers from Lynn Moulton Howe, as I mentioned, Spartan 1 and 2, as well as Brian S. And he is, in my opinion, the most reputable. He speaks of going to rescue the scientists who were dropped off and went missing for about a week. And I'll tell you, Tony, the conditions are so extreme in Antarctica. If you go missing even a day,
I'm sure you're
done. Probably going to be presumed as dead.
Right.
So when they popped up a week later and nobody would talk and they had an ashen look over their face, leads you to believe that they must have gone down somewhere to get out of the harsh conditions. Plus, there were rescue parties looking for them. They couldn't find them. And so Brian S. says that even when they took them back to McMurdo, they were quarantined and still wouldn't talk about what they had seen. And then they went back to New Zealand and were quarantined and debriefed once again. Now, what's interesting, I've learned that there's a building in the McMurdo base that's run by the NSA, but nobody knows anything going on in or out. Nobody's allowed in there. But the NSA is specifically tasked for anything UFO related. Remember the old acronym, right? No such agency, that it took until the 1980s for them to even admit that the NSA existed. So the fact that they're operating with their own building in McMurdo, as well as they do work out of the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station, not too far from where that big hole under the ice is located, leads me to believe that they know that something's going on down there.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think there's going to be some significance in life and planet-changing technology. And what do you think of somebody that's been there and heard some of these whistleblowers and even done your research, how significant Antarctica is with ufology and just technology?
Well, it's hugely significant when it comes to the last landmass on the planet that has been unblemished by human activity. Even the animals are not afraid of people. There's so few people down there. Right now, it's the off season. There's only 1,000 people on the entire continent.
Oh, wow.
Just in some of the bases that go year round. Everybody clears out of there by the end of March. And you don't want to stay there either. I mean, the days, if you're in the South Pole Station, 4 months of pitch darkness. And that starts to drive people crazy. And there were stories about people that didn't want to stay for the whole season and going nuts and one doctor at one of the bases we visited burned down the base because he said, I won't stay here. And then they had to take him out of there. So it's one of those things. It's like, boy, if you wanted to punish someone, send them to Antarctica. That would be the worst thing to do.
Instead of Guantanamo, they send them down to the Antarctica. So why is it known sometimes as Illuminati Disneyland?
Well, that was the nickname that had been going around ever since all the elite went down there. Do you remember John Kerry was there on election day? You'd think he'd have more to do up in the states helping his party win the election.
Right.
But no, he's down in Antarctica right then when Trump gets elected. And this friend of mine who I know that works at McMurdo, the largest base in Antarctica run by the Americans, he remembers it. They landed with big fanfare. I mean, anytime anybody shows up, it's a big deal. So few people are down there, let alone the acting Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And he went further afield for several days, and still nobody knows exactly where he went, but it's presumably to speak to some of these globalists that have secret bases down there and basically explain, look, this guy Trump, he won the election, what do we do now? And then he came back with his marching orders. So there's just so much mystery going on there, Tony, and I think this is why a lot of rumors start pertaining to Antarctica. Right. It's almost like you say you saw something on Mars. Well, how does anybody actually verify that? How do we fact check that? And you really can't. And it's almost the same way with Antarctica. It is just so vast. It's the second, it's the fifth largest continent in the world. So it's like two Australias combined. So to go anywhere to check out some of these claims or what you see on Google Earth is just so cost prohibitive, and you have to be a very specialized team to do it. It's not for everybody.
Right.
In fact, we got terribly seasick crossing the Drake Passage.
I remember you saying
that. I lost about 25 pounds on that trip just because I was throwing up for 5 days or all the food. I didn't eat for that long. And
so
that's what happens.
What about with climate change? And I mean, because blame it on humans or blame it on just natural change, because, you know, as we've seen over millions of years, the climate has, you know, ups and downs. How is that going to affect Antarctica? And is it going to expose potentially what we've all been thinking about when it comes to the secrets down there?
Well, it is changing rapidly, and it was very evident along the Palmer Peninsula portion of Antarctica where I went to. And in my presentation called The Hidden Anomalies of Antarctica, which I'll present at Contact in the Desert, one of the first slides I'll show is this NASA slide of doing the a heat map. So areas that are warming up very rapidly in red, including the region I went to. But paradoxically, there are areas that are cooling down and actually accumulating more snow and ice. And perhaps this is how Mother Nature balances out the sea level changes haven't really risen. Somehow Mother Nature has this innate knowledge to keep the balance just right down there. So there are areas that are melting, but then there's other areas that are building in ice as well. And that's why Miami Beach isn't underwater like we heard some predictions it might be.
Right. By 2050, I think, is when they said it could be. New York, Miami, all that good stuff. And before we move on to another topic, I'm curious, because during the Nazi reign and Hitler, they did have a base down there, and I think that really is what intrigued people and what brought attention to the Antarctica. What was known, do you know of anything before Antarctica? How did they, the Nazis and Hitler, even discover anything to do with Antarctica?
Well, at first they were very interested in protecting the sea lanes. That is,
got it.
U-boat traffic and right. supply lines, and they were really the sea wolves of the Atlantic. And just keep in mind that South Africa was an apartheid fascist government well into the 1980s, and they were sympathetic to the Nazi cause. The New Schwabenland area is directly south of South Africa, and that's where the presumed New Berlin base was built. So they were mining for natural resources. They're doing whaling, and they were very concerned with this the sea lanes from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, as well as attempting to control the sea lanes in the Drake Passage, which is between the Pacific and the Atlantic. And that's one of the main reasons that the British went down there and set up bases during the war to monitor the Nazis in New Berlin. And we went to visit two of the old British bases.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that yeah. had been used to spy on the Nazis. One of them was a museum, which you can visit today. You can even send a postcard from the southernmost post office in the world. And another was turned over to the Ukrainians and is now the Vernansky base. And that had originally been British, built during this time of Operation Tamberlane when they were spying on the Germans during the war. So there's been a lot of intrigue as far as who's doing what down there. And even though it's such a frozen and foreboding land, it's still very strategic in many ways. And now it's being utilized as an air base and research stations. Air base as far as just bringing in supplies, right. not necessarily for military operations anymore.
So how did you, I mean, that's a big, because when you, I remember when, you was on the show right before you went to Antarctica, and then you did came back and was on the show afterwards. And you would think that would be your sole place to go, because that's taking a lot of energy, a lot of physical strength to go down and, like you said, sick for 5 days on a crossing, you know, a strait and all that stuff. But you also went to South America and did some research, you know, Peru, Bolivia, and I'm curious what you found down there. Was there any significant, not significant, but any connections to Antarctica that you saw, or was what was the purpose of doing those trips together, not separately? Because that's a lot.
Right, right.
That's a lot.
Well, it was mainly the South America trip was the majority of the 4 months I was away, and I bought a vehicle and drove about 5,000 kilometers,
wow.
3,500 miles on it, bought it and sold it down there, and parked it in Ushuaia for 26 days when I was on the boat to and from. And then I sold it in El Chetlan. But so the point of it was just to get around, one, transportation. It was already set up and outfitted for a excursion such as this. So it was also a sleeping vehicle, and it was all set up with camping and cooking gear.
Right.
So it really scored when I got this vehicle. And had I not sold it, I would have gone back down there and got it and maybe drove back up through Central America. But got a good offer at the end, and yeah, just
couldn't pass it up.
Yeah, but so the connection really is only proximity, that Ushuaia, Argentina, is the southernmost city of the world, and it's the closest point to get to Antarctica. It's where those two fingers of land come closest together, that is, the southern tip of South America, and then that northern tip of the Palmer Peninsula sticking up. And there are a whole bunch of islands around there too, and sea lanes and passages. So we only really got seasick on the way down and not on the way back. Yep, there it is. And you can see that Drake Passage right in between. the roughest seas in the world. And even people who take cruise ships, where almost all the sea passage to Antarctica leaves from Ushuaia, 50% of all passengers on cruise ships also get seasick. So it wasn't just because I was in a sailboat, but that's just the nature of the Drake Shake, as it's called.
So we'll talk about some of the lost technology that, because we've all the shows that Truth Be Told has done, we've always say the technology that we've learned was through aliens or UFOs and other worldly creatures. But a lot of us believe that we had higher technology before something happened on this planet to where we lost it. And then because a lot of the, you know, pyramids in Egypt and a lot of the pyramids and structures in South America, it's hard to believe that they did that on their own. It's hard to believe they were so precise and the cuts were so great and being able to lift tons of rock into place. What were you surprised about? Because when you read it and see it on television, but when you're actually there to see the structures, that's when it kicks in and going, wow, this was hard to believe they did this just with primitive technology.
Yeah, and if you look at that background image you're using, Tony, you can see that there are clearly two different construction styles.
Yeah, it looks like
one
it.
One above with the megaliths that are so finely placed together,
mm-hmm.
and then the more inferior Incan and Spanish style of building, which, by the way, every time there's a big earthquake, those newer constructions come tumbling down, whereas the older megalithic pre-Incan designs
stick.
They seem to have been built that way to withstand the big earthquakes, which of course Chile and Argentina and Peru
they
are right there
ones.
Along the yeah, the Ring of Fire, and there's active volcanoes there and real big earthquakes from time to time. So I think the ancients, these pre-Incan cultures who did the most impressive megalithic buildings in South America, well, were cognizant of these earthquakes and perhaps built that way, but did their building in such a way as almost to tempt future generations to say, hey, let's see if you can build like this. And the answer is we still can't even build that way. the Japanese attempted to build a small replica of the Great Pyramid a few decades ago, and they failed miserably. They couldn't even finish the project. And then when you look at the quarries where a lot of these stones came from, oftentimes on the top of a mountain, down a steep hillside, across a river, up another steep hillside. So even the moving of these massive, and here we are in Sacsayhuaman, just above Cusco, 30 feet tall megaliths weighing
huge.
Over 100 tons. They are just massive. And you can see how expertly placed together they are, as well as these this marshmallowing effect of those megaliths that just sort of curve out as if they were at one point malleable or more fluid, because you never find chisel marks either, Tony. They're
That's
always
what's fascinating.
So perfectly put together, yeah, where you can't even stick a credit card or a piece of paper in those joints. And then you notice on the bottom there, they have those little knobs that protrude. So it's like the stones were set into place and they were wet or still moving and then created that marshmallow effect and then popped out those little knobs at the end. So I was there with Brian Forrester and Nassim Harriman.
Oh my God, I love
it. Two other speakers at Contact in the Desert commonly. And was great to hear in a scientific way how these new technology may have been employed in the building of the megaliths, such as a cold plasma state of rendering these stones malleable. And Tony, oftentimes we would come across a site such as Oyate-Tambo or at Sacsayhuaman, where it appears there was someone with a trowel, much like someone who works in plaster, was working these stones with some kind of instrument that left like trowel marks on the stones. And I'll show that in my presentation, The Megaliths and Mysteries of South America. Many of these trowel-like stones, inviting your listeners to my presentation at Contact in the Desert, well, where I'll get into this a lot more detail, as well as the as yet unknown method of using auditive levitation to move these massive stones. This too is now a technology that is only beginning to be understood. And you can levitate certain smaller objects, mm-hmm. and you can go on YouTube and see these videos, including a live frog flapping around or a bowling ball. But 70 or 100 ton stones, boy, that's a different ball game.
It is.
But I suppose once you have that technology, you can employ it and scale it up in certain ways to use it for the building and moving of these megalithic buildings.
Well, I'm going to take a quick break because I want to promote the conference that you're going to be speaking at. I'll be there too. And when we come back, I want to ask you and see maybe where you think that technology went and see what happened to it. So don't go anywhere. We're talking to Brad Olson. You can go to bradolson.com. And I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. So don't go anywhere right now.
When you start to ask the question, it unfolds the fabric of space itself, how it's made. What is it made of?
We're not alone in this universe. We never have been.
Alien intelligences have cohabited with us on this planet for millions of years.
We inherited the obsession from the Anunnaki.
Anyone that still thinks that we're the ones that are obsessed with gold does not know enough about the true history of our species, how we came to be here,
and the conditions that brought us here.
We are not unique in this universe. Extraterrestrials do exist. We are, so to say, the copies of them.
We're back. I'm Tony Sweet. I'm here with Brad Olson. And as you can see the banner up there, Brad is going to be speaking, doing a workshop and a lecture. Brad, can you tell us what your lecture and workshop is about? Kind of like what we're talking about today.
Sure. Yeah. I'm doing my presentation called The Latest Evidence and Hidden Anomalies of Antarctica on Friday. And I'm also going to be on the Forbidden Archaeology panel on Friday. And then on Sunday, I'll be presenting the Megaliths and Mysteries of South America workshop. Invite your listeners to come and check it out. And I'm also going to be at the meet and greet of the authors on Friday night, toasting a glass of wine to Contact in the Desert and this wonderful virtual event that they're putting on at the end of June. We're really looking forward to it.
Well, yeah, it's usually out in the desert here in Palm Springs area and Joshua Tree. And this year, unfortunately, it's virtual, but I'm sure next year they'll be back in the desert. And it's always been a great time to get together with everybody and hear new discoveries and even just rehash some of the old myths and realities that a lot of these speakers bring to the table. So we thank them for doing that, and thank you, Contact in the Desert, for putting on at least a conference this year. So that was good. But Brad, before we went to our little break, we were talking about how, you know, South America, Peru, Bolivia, how they created some of these amazing walls and megaliths and putting them together, and how they did it without, like you said, even technology today has a hard time doing. But I wanted to find out, what do you think, where this technology went? How did it disappear, do you think? Because it's hard to believe it just disappeared and it's right in front of us. You know, we have the proof in front of us, but we just don't have the technology to understand how they did it.
Yeah, that is one of the great mysteries. That's why I love this field of research, Tony, is to look into where else you can find these megalithic buildings. And it really is a worldwide phenomenon.
Right.
Megaliths can be found in Asia, of course, in Egypt and many locations in Europe, as well as in South America and Central America. So perhaps there was some kind of field of study that was global at one time. Perhaps they were sharing information and techniques for building. I kind of find it hard to believe that this is just a one-off where
right.
all certain people discovered it on their own in a certain way. Because the other interesting thing about these megaliths is that the older they are, the larger they are as well. And everything keeps getting dated as older and older and older. So it was almost like there was technology in the world that had existed. And ever since then, this building technique in a megalithic style has degraded and gotten poorer in quality. And usually it would be the other way around, that you'd start out in poor quality and then work your way up to right. getting it really refined. But that's not the case. So the older it is, the more megalithic and interesting in its size it is.
And so was there a period, when was the period that it kind of disappeared? You know how sometimes when Neanderthals and humans kind of intertwined, but there's always that period that it was missing. Is there a time that we know that the being built and then discovery of like a missing time period that may have been when all this technology disappeared?
Well, there are these cycles that we go through. The Indians describe them as the Yuga cycles. And over the last 20,000 years or so, we've been in a dark age. We've been in a forgetful phase where these megaliths, which are much, much older than that,
right.
they go back into more of a golden age that may have once existed on this earth. And I really enjoy the work of Michael Tellinger, who speaks yeah. of those gold mines that have been found in South Africa. I'd love to go down there and do a tour with him to Adam's Calendar. And these may be the oldest monuments in the world. And perhaps humans had their DNA tinkered with to create Homo sapien and work these gold mines. That's the common narrative ever since Zechariah Sitchin has developed his books and theories on where humans came from. So can we even say that these megaliths, as old as they are, were even built by humans? Look, there are definitely giants in the world. There right. are these elongated skulls and other archaeological digs of very, very massive human-like, but not quite human giants. And maybe moving around these megaliths would have been a lot easier for
right.
a being that's two or four or 10 times our size. It's not out of the realm of possibilities. And perhaps that's why they built in such a large fashion too, was to accommodate larger people.
And I think the show before you came on, I interviewed somebody before, and we were talking about Bigfoot. And a lot of people nowadays are starting to think Bigfoot could be part of the giants that walked the earth. And you know, these bones that have been discovered, of course they hide these discoveries, but you know, that might be a possibility of of how, like you said, how they moved, you know, because even look at gorillas are what, 10 times stronger than we are. So if you have somebody or something that's 8 to 10 feet tall and definitely going to be a lot stronger than humans. That's a possibility that these giants were part of that build and could have been alien born. So.
Well, that's why I love these conferences like Contact in the Desert, because we can throw these different theories out there and base it on evidence, and we can come to different conclusions. This is really the cutting edge in many ways of science and technology and our history. And we have a right to know this, and we should be having these discussions, because there are so many loose ends and inconsistencies in the history we've been told that it's good for other researchers from various parts of the world to come together and share what they know. And these are important events.
Well, we want to make sure we talk about your, because you've written many books, and I'd like to talk to finish out the show, your latest, Beyond Esoteric. Can you tell us a little bit about this latest book and what's so special about it, Brad? Come on.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Well, it's the third and final in the Esoteric series. It took me 6 years to put together.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I've had other projects.
Right.
I'm not slacking off here. It's just this. But the COVID lockdown last year certainly gave me the impetus to finish it up. And I'm really glad I did. And it just got done at the end of last year. Just came out early this year. And I include my Antarctica material. The black goo is in it. A lot of the megalithic and South America findings came out in this book, but really a whole lot more. It gets into the subtitle being Escaping Prison Planet, really the neo-fascism that has now enveloped many of the governments of the world to the point where we now realize that it's these private held corporations that control the governments that are making these moves. So just showing a lot of evidence that this is the case in the world today, as well as the embargo section about all the subjects that have been withheld from humanity. And then the final section is called Ubermind, ways that humans are moving into human 2.0, sometimes without our even knowing it, being terraformed in different ways and transhumanist agenda, and also going into the properties of crystals and exotic metals, including monatomic gold, which has been found in some of the sacred places around the world, including the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, residue dust of monatomic gold. So just a lot of these subjects that have been really withheld from humanity. And that's the nature of what esoteric means, is that it's knowledge only gained by a select few. So I'm trying to just open this up to the mass audience in this book. And because I believe we all have a right to know this material, it shouldn't just be bottled up by that select few that has been holding on to this for a very long time. So all that has been hidden is being revealed, Tony, and I make it my job to help people understand those subjects.
And the good thing about you, there's a lot of people that I've interviewed, and one thing about you, you can tell you're passionate about it, and you love what you do, and you are very determined to share it with the audience and the fans and whatever you want to call them, and people that'll listen. So, I mean, everybody in the chat room, they love you. You can tell they're very, very, you're influential to them. So, thank you for putting yourself out there and, risking your life on even some of this stuff. Cause some of this stuff being exposed can put you in a predicament of, people watching you and not in a positive way. So thank you for doing what you do.
Well, thank you for understanding, and for the fans out there to recognize my work and my passion for this. And you're absolutely right. I do it because I am in service to all, and I'm a very good storyteller, I'm
you
told,
are.
And I'm able to relate a lot of these sometimes complex issues in a simplified way, if that's a way to put it. But I just feel that we are part of this great awakening, that humanity is having this wake-up moment for really the first time. And a lot of us are here with a specific idea of how we can contribute to that great awakening, myself included, and my new book, Beyond Esoteric, Escaping Prison Planet. And welcome your listeners to check this book out if they haven't already. And you know what I love to do, Tony, is always ask my host, what does the Escaping Prison Planet mean to you? If you care to take a shot at that, I always love to hear, because it's a different answer from every host that I'm with.
Well, the thing, when what first popped into my mind, I always felt like I was always on the outside anyway. I was always a question boy. Even when I was a kid, I had questions and questions and questions, and I never really believed a lot of the myths. I never believed in even some of the religion that was taught to us. So Escaping Prison Planet, I feel like what that means is when you're trying to escape the constriction of the powers that be, be it religion, be it government, be it, you know, some people can even refer to it as parents, is just really having an open mind and seeking the truth and trying to understand what this planet is all about and where we came from and where we're going. So I think Escaping the Prison Planet is, it's just really opening your mind and seeing what the truth is. And a lot of the truth is right in front of our face. And just not letting somebody else's views from day one control you, but keeping an open mind. Cause I can tell you were probably the same as me. You were probably seeking the truth from a young age.
Absolutely. And that was a great reply. Thank you for adding that.
Oh, of course. And of course.
And we're all in this together, as you know.
And I hope you guys in the chat room that you can tell us what you think Escaping Prison Planet. I'd love to hear what they think too. So, but a month and a half, not even a month and a half. Yeah, about a month and a half away. Brad's going to be at Contact in the Desert. He's going to be doing a lecture, a workshop. Get your tickets. It's virtual. If you've never had a chance to go to Contact in the Desert because, you know, it's too far, the plane tickets, a hotel room, you don't have to do that this year. You can actually just go and buy a virtual ticket. You can be a part of the Contact in the Desert, and there's over 60 speakers, and some of the top speakers in the world. And Brad is going to be there, and he's going to bring his experience and his knowledge. And it's not that expensive, you guys, it's well worth the purchase. And some of these people is, you know, George Norrie and Nick Pope, Linda Moulton Howe, Eric Von Daniken, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Some of your favorites. And again, thank you, Brad, for being a part of it. And thank you for coming back and being part of Truth Be Told again. I don't know how many times you've been on, but several times.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Tony. And thanks for having me on Truth Be Told. It's a great show, and you had a wonderful audience. And like I said, we'll look forward to seeing everybody virtually at Contact the Desert in about 6 weeks from now, and yep. We'll pick up the discussion then.
All right. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us in the chat room. I love your comments, love your questions, and please tune in every Friday right here on Truth Be Told channel. Subscribe, leave a comment, make sure it's a good one, and we'd love to have you share this show. Until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told, and don't forget,
step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
You can watch us on WCRN TV Boston. We're now streaming every Saturday, truth be told. So until then, I'll see you next time.